Hack, session number 30018, Reel 10.
John Farley, Reel 10. So I'm going to ask you how dangerous the profession of test pilot was by the time that you were on the course.
The question of how dangerous test flying is one that often crops up when you talk to people who are not in the business and socially or whatever, and the general public perceive test flying as dangerous. It is not dangerous today. It was dangerous in the past, and the difference between the past and today happened at about my generation. But that's just how it is. It's not me just saying it. It literally is like that. During my time as an apprentice, which was 1950 to 1955, I'm flying as a flight test observer. I'm getting to know test pilots. I have an abnormal interest in what is going on the airfield and around me. There were 47 accidents to Farnborough-based test aeroplanes in the 5 years during my time at Farnborough. 47. I'd have to go and look at the records to know how many of them were fatal, but I would think it's probably half were fatal accidents. Well, that was a striking rate of sort of one most months, not every month, but sort of 10 a year. 47 in 5 years, 9.5 a year. That's a lot of accidents. A rate which modern youngsters would find difficult to comprehend. One of those accidents was to Wimpy Wade, who was the chief test pilot of Hawkers at the time. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute, you're talking about Farnborough airplanes. Well, the aeroplane that Wimpy was testing, the 1081, the Hawker P-1081, was based at Farnborough in a hangar there because they had better security, and the security at Dunsfold was not considered adequate for this new swept-wing fighter research aeroplane. And so, as it happened, I think it was 1951 or 2, I'd have to check, but I watched Wimpy take off because it was during my lunch hours. I was cycling around the taxi track. I mean, he was just taking off in the 1081. And I went to college that afternoon, and when we came out of college, we heard that he'd crashed and been killed. And that was it was actually 51, it wasn't 52, it was 51. And so Hawkers had lost their chief test pilot. The next Hawker pilot, let alone chief test pilot, but any Hawker pilot at all to be killed, was Jim Hawkins in 1985 or 6, 86. So we'd gone from 1951 to 1986 without a fatal accident. That, I think, is probably sufficient evidence that there'd been a fundamental change. Now, the day Jim was killed, and he was killed during a demonstration rehearsal where he hit the ground at the bottom of a loop, or pull through, for reasons that don't matter here, if you had gone along to our insurance company and said, look, let's go back to Wimpy. If in 51 you had gone along to an insurance company and said, we've just lost our chief test pilot. Oh, what's he been doing? Okay, now we're going to have to buy another one. Can we insure him, please? Well, what's he going to be doing? Oh, well, he's going to be developing a new swept-wing jet aeroplane for the Royal Air Force. How do you do that one? We don't know yet. I see. Well, if he does that, what's he going to do next? Oh, he's going to develop the first vertical landing jet fighter for the Royal Air Force. How are you going to do that? We don't know yet. Well, you'd have been laughed out of the office in terms of the premium, wouldn't you? People would realistically have said, I don't want anything to know with that sort of risk level. But it was 1986. And if you'd gone along to them before we lost the next one. Now, there were 17 pilots between We're flying at Dunsfold between Wimpy's accident date and Jim's accident date. 17 pilots. Not all at the same time. You know what I mean by a team of guys. 17 blokes involved in test flying between those two accident dates. If you'd gone along at the same time as Wimpy went in and said, all right, well, we'll have to insure him ourselves. Okay, but look, we're going to have 17 guys doing this job over the next 25 years. 1951 to 86, that's 35 years. Over the next 35 years, we're going to have 17 pilots doing this job. Can we insure their kids? What do you mean, can we insure their kids? Well, these are guys who are going to get married, have a bunch of kids, and can we insure them to grow up? Well, what do you mean by grow up? Reach the age of 30? Okay. Then you would have got a perfectly notional policy, premium, I would have said. Well, those 17 guys lost 7 kids while they were, you know, during that time. Accident, illness, and 1 suicide. So, I know that the statistics of small samples are bad news, but in terms of validity, but the principle is there. People think test flying is dangerous. They don't think being a kid is dangerous. Now, the kids realise this. The Dunsfold test pilots' kids realised they were in trouble. The day one of the daughters got killed in a horse-riding accident, I went into my daughter's bedroom that evening. She was 7 or 8 at the time. And, she was 9. To tell her that one of her best mates had been killed in a horse riding accident that afternoon. And she was asleep, and so I sort of crept out, as you do. And as I was shutting the door, I heard her say, Daddy. So I went back in, and I said, you wait. She said, yes. I said, I've got some bad news. Joanna was killed this afternoon. Oh, what happened? I told her. She said, well, she's the test pilot's daughter, and went back to sleep. So, you know, it's... test flying is not dangerous during my time in the business. And the reasons for it were twofold. By far the most important reason was that my generation of test pilots were properly trained to be test pilots, were properly educated, and were not just devil-may-care guys who... if a chief designer said, see how fast it would go, then just climbed as high as it would go, turned it and pointed it straight at the ground, and then came back and told the chief designer how fast it would go. Providing the wings didn't come off in the meantime, of course. So we were trained to evaluate aeroplanes. Safety had happened. It wasn't today's health and safety, and I can't work in your kitchen at 7 feet above the floor without on a step. You know, if the guy comes in now, it's gone ridiculous. But it had to be improved over what we had in Wimpy Wade's day. And it has been improved. So, no, I don't think test flying is dangerous. It's a case of taking calculated risks, or calculated risk being taken by experienced, competent and professional people. Not just the test pilots, but the engineers, the airworthiness engineers, the flight test engineers, the whole team. I won't say it's mundane, but it's not a dangerous job.
Is that partly brought about by a change in culture in the whole of the aviation industry? Because you mentioned it was the designers and the ground, as well as the pilots themselves. It's this more of an understanding of what you're doing.
Absolutely. No question. Yep. Yep.
Was there an element with the earlier test pilots? Because obviously the public perception of test pilots as being a dangerous job comes from that period of the early 50s, really. But was there an element there of... you've mentioned the experimental types of aircraft that they were flying. Was there any element that the aircraft could have been at fault at that period, or was it a combination of the pilot and the aircraft sometimes?
Oh, I think it was very often the airplane. I don't know what very often is, 60-70% of the time. It was a technical failure that caused the accident. and 20-30% of the time it was the pilot was not up to the job that he was asked to do. Now, you could seriously question whether that made it a pilot error accident. In other words, should the design organisation have expected that sort of test to be carried out because they had not got the slightest idea what the result would be? Do you follow? There were some of those. Some of those 47 accidents I talked about or mentioned, things dropped off aeroplanes because they weren't bolted on properly. You know, there were maintenance errors. I mean, an aircraft came out of the hangar after an engine and propeller change, and the first thing that happened when the bloke got off the end of the runway 25 was the propeller came off. You see? So, yes, there were technical failures with aeroplanes, but there were technical failures out in the world that wasn't test flying aeroplanes as well. The whole business of aviation was still developing and was much more dangerous in those days than it is today.
And was it partly, would you say, a hangover from the Second World War and how pilots are viewed? Because obviously there were massive casualties amongst pilots and air crew during the Second World War. Was it almost seen as an acceptable risk, would you say, in the early 50s?
Oh, I'm sure it was. Once the enemy stopped bombing and trying to kill us in our houses, and this glorious day had happened, when the war is over, you know, which is all people have talked about, one day when the war is over, there was suddenly this sort of sense of there's no more risk in life anymore. Quite naturally, because this huge risk, which people could do nothing to mitigate, the individual couldn't, other than going to air raid shelter when he was told to, sort of thing, this huge level of risk vanished, and now we were just left with risks that we caused in our own little lives, riding our motorbikes or driving our motor cars or whatever it was. And so I think this notion of what was safe and what wasn't safe had a big perturbation at the end of the Second World War. And so, yes, I'm sure that a lot of test pilots thought, well, in the late 40s and 50s, they had this attitude of, well, nobody shooting at me, you know. I'm not saying all of them, but, I mean, there was some of that. It takes time for change, for this culture, this safety culture, to change.
So was it a change, really, from full-blown on risk to, as you said yourself, the term calculated risk? Is that the shift that changed in the test pilot's ethos? Because you're saying, in a sense, you do step across both worlds, because you experienced the first kind of test pilot world and then obviously went on to a second generation. But is it that balance between risk and calculated risk that changed on a personal level with how you did things?
Yes, I think I was more advantaged than some people of my generation. I'll pick my words carefully. Because my background of that 5 years at Farnborough was a big help. I mean, one or two of the students on my course at ETPS were killed in flying accidents. One of them 6 weeks after the course. Another one a couple of years after the course, and so on. And I'm not sure that I would have been killed in the same circumstances, because these guys had not had my experience of being at Farnborough and the slightly more questioning approach to things that have been indoctrinated in me by the scientists and engineers at Farnborough. It's a very subtle thing, isn't it? The influences you get exposed to. I mean, in no way was my upbringing as an apprentice a negative thing. Oh, you mustn't take risk. And no way was it, oh, we can't try that just in case it doesn't work. On the contrary, that was going on all the time. But people still thought about it and did it deliberately. It was progressive, like everything else we've been talking about. And as you say, I happen to be just at the cusp of it all, really.
So after your preview, was that the final stage of the course? Or was there no other thing to pass out or test?
No. Once we had done our preview, that was it. And as it is indeed today at ETPS, that is still the situation. Although the preview is a team exercise today, it was an individual exercise. That's a minor point of detail, and merely reflecting the bigger teams of people and the need to operate as a team and the need to learn the skills of being a member of a team, not a bright individual apparently in the same team. But you've got a team of two people, they should be as effective as 2.5 people if they're properly used. But two individuals aren't going to be worth 2.5 people, you know. So yeah, the preview was it, and I was then posted to the aerodynamics research flight at Bedford. Aerodynamics research flight was at Farnborough when I was an apprentice. The sort of aeroplanes that they were flying were getting a bit much for the airfield, in that they would have wished for a slightly longer runway and less built up countryside round the airfield. That was the sort of concept. Well, we must get out into the Bundu a bit and build a longer runway and a wider runway. So they did all that because they perceived that airplanes are going to get bigger, faster and heavier and take off and land faster and faster all the time. And so they built this place and moved aerodynamics research flight to Bedford. And at the end of the course, ETPS course, I had done quite well, and another guy had done quite well, Mike Adams. Mike was a squadron leader, I was a flight lieutenant. Mike was a career RAF officer, I was a direct entry guy. Mike was very experienced, much more experienced in the Air Force than I was. He got 2 or 3 tours. And I know from talking to the tutors since, one didn't know it at the time, they weren't quite sure what to do with the two of us because we had both done quite well. There is a very prestigious pot given to the top student, McKenna Trophy, at the Empire Test Pilot School. And I'm sure on many courses it was difficult to decide who to give it to. But what I was told was, well, we didn't know what to do with you two guys, so we gave Mike the pot and you the job that you both wanted. And I mean, Mike and I are great mates, and we talk about it. I've talked about it since, and he said, "Well, you know, I'd have happily given up the buddy pot for the job." We weren't offered a choice. That is what they did. So Mike got the very good job, which was the fighter test squadron at Boscombe Down. But I got the aerodynamics research flight, so I got what I wanted, which was. And I imagine in many ways I was probably slightly more suited by virtue of my background to doing the aerodynamics research flight job. But I got the number 2 trophy and Mike got the pot. And I was totally happy to go to Bedford, I can tell you.
What about the other graduates from the course? Where could they expect to go? Where would the other places in the RAF be for test pilot?
There were only three places in those days that you went to: Bedford, and I'd taken the slot at Bedford, Boscombe Down, of which they normally had several slots, and Farnborough, where they had many slots. Farnborough in general was being used to develop the equipment and technology that were going into aeroplanes, and where new bomb aiming devices or navigational systems or whatever, or head up displays, etc., were being tried out in what they called hack aeroplanes. In other words, the platform itself was not a sort of revolutionary piece of kit or under development. It was just being used as a vehicle to try out some of this kit. Boscombe Down, on the other hand, was evaluating the aeroplanes that were supposedly ready for the Royal Air Force, and so that was the Airworthiness and Service Release Centre for testing, and they were the three places that you went to. And Boscombe had quite a few test pilots. Farnborough probably had the largest number because there were many different programmes going on in 1964, which is the year we're talking about. and Bedford had one slot at that time. Well, funnily enough, in one of these sort of coincidences in life, the first person I met when I walked into the office block at Bedford on my first day there was a chap called Ralph Maltby, who was a scientist at Bedford and had been my apprentice master in 1954. So, I mean, what a coincidence sort of thing. And anyhow, he was coming down the stairs, I was going up the stairs, to meet my new boss, Coordinator Jack Henderson. And so there I was, off and running with my time at Bedford. There were four pilots at Bedford, on the aerodynamics research flight at Bedford. There was the boss, Coordinator Jack Henderson. There was a Lieutenant Commander from the Royal Navy, Paul Millett, a Flight Lieutenant Clive Rustin, and myself just joining as the junior guy. Replacing another flight lieutenant who was Turex, Ian Kepi. And so I joined this very happy band of people who had a hangar full of aeroplanes. A bit daunting, actually. There was every single research aeroplane then flying in the United Kingdom. We're talking Short SC-1, Short SB-5, Hunting 126, Fairy Delta 2, Handley Page 115, you know, airplanes like that, as well as a whole raft of other airplanes, service airplanes and helicopters that were being used to carry equipment or for particular jobs. We had a couple of Meteors that we used mainly for communications work, but one of them was also equipped for GUS research. So it was a very interesting place to be, and I wandered round the hangar that first day looking at this lot, thinking I'd never learn to fly that lot. And I would probably have run away screaming into the distance saying I can't do that if it hadn't been for a comment made by Stan Hubbard. Now, Stan Hubbard was an RAF wing commander who I had just happened to meet at Strubby, an RAF base, about 40 months earlier in the bar one evening. I didn't know that he was actually going to be the chief test flying instructor at ETPS when I met him. And so he was just somebody I fell into conversation with. And he said, what are you going to do then? And I said, oh, I'm hoping to go to Bedford. And he didn't let on, you know, he just said, oh, they've got lots of airplanes there, I think. And I said, yeah, I hope I can cope. He said, well, remember, he said, they all work exactly the same way. If you pull a stick back, he said, the nose goes up and the houses get smaller. You know, it was that sort of trick. And if you push it forward, the nose goes down and they all get bigger. You know, and it is absolutely true. And then he went on to say that he was going to be at ETPS, and we had quite a sensible conversation about the course and the problems I was likely to experience. And He had himself been at Bedford as a test pilot some years earlier and was a very experienced aviator. And the point he made to me was that if you're going to jump into many different types of airplanes each month, I mean, some months in my logbook I had over 20 airplanes, different types. If you're going to jump in and out of that number of airplanes, and perhaps you only fly each one four or five times a year, then there's a lot of stuff that you need to remember, you know, which is not right up the top of your brain. And therefore you need to make yourself checklists and so on for each aeroplane, carry them with you. And very importantly, he said, there's not a lot to learn about the aeroplanes, but there's a great deal to learn about the engines, and you must know your engines inside out. The good thing is there's probably only four or five different engines in 35 or 38 aeroplanes, because the Avon was a very common turbojet at that time. I mean, there were several others, but he was absolutely right. You know, it wasn't so difficult to stay on top of the engines, what their limits were, how you started them, how you relit them, that sort of thing, because they were common to many of the aeroplanes. But the sort of programmes that were going on were driven by the boffins. I mean, the four RAF pilots were just there to serve the boffins and do whatever they wanted. So it was a wonderful place to learn about aeroplanes. And of course, because with my apprenticeship I had I'd worked with the boffins at Farnborough and Bedford for 5 years, there wasn't a sort of quite the same cultural problem that there was with some service test pilots when they got sent to a place like that excuse me, where they'd only worked with other military personnel and so on. And you know, boffins are a bit different, and that's not to say they are in any way worse, it's just that they are totally different from a lot of the service can do thing. You know, they sit in the corner of the room and think, you know, stuff like that.
What was your initial work then? What were you involved in at first?
The first experimental aeroplane that I flew, I think it was in January, it might have been February, was the Handley Page 115, which was a very slender delta, 76 degree sweep, and was one of three aeroplanes that Aeroflight used during my time on the Concorde research program. And I mean, we're talking 1964, and RAE, Aerodynamics Department, as opposed to the Aerodynamics Research Flight Bunch, which was a sort of arm of Aerodynamics Department. RAE Aerodynamics Department was trying to decide on the optimum wing shape and so on for the Concorde, which wasn't going to happen until the next decade. And they knew what they wanted for the cruise. It was a very slender delta, and that was obviously going to be the most efficient in when they did their sums and their wind tunnel tests. But a slender delta has unusual low speed handling characteristics, especially laterally and directionally, that is in roll and yaw. If you think about it, an aeroplane that is very long and thin and doesn't have much in the way of wingspan like a Concorde is not going to behave in turbulence or on finals in exactly the same way as, shall we say, a glider whose wing tips are almost out at each horizon. An aircraft with a higher aspect ratio, as a glider is said to have, tends to be relatively slow in its rolling motions, in the way it changes bank with respect to a gust and so on. Whereas an aircraft that has got virtually no span tends to almost rock about its long axis and reacts very quickly indeed. And very easy for, or so the boffins thought, for a pilot to over-control the aeroplane because it has, send it out, because it has no roll damping. Damping being this sort of natural effect, which you can imagine on a long glider wing when that's going down. These air coming up underneath that wing, you know, which is slowing the way the wing goes down. And when you think of the air on the other wing where the wing is going up, that air is apparently coming down on top of that wing. So it's that's what's called aerodynamic damping, and it's just common sense. It's nothing clever about it. Well, of course, a very slender airplane doesn't have that sort of damping. And as soon as you touch the ailerons or the lateral control, it tends to whiz away. So there was this fear that people could over-control. And so before Farnborough could commit themselves to a slender delta, they thought we'd better build a research prototype to have a look at these handling characteristics. And that was the Handley Page 115. So it was an aircraft that was specified by the RAE, as they had specified other aeroplanes, actually, other research aeroplanes. And
can I hold you?